Lady Justice is suing Congress for defamation after the impeachment proceedings made a mockery out of trials. Cops searched a container in plain view in a car that said, bag full of drugs, and the coronavirus is being beaten back by lawyers. These stories, plus we will relive the glory days of the magical Super Bowl run by our great hometown Kansas City Chiefs in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Well, folks, today we have crossed the Rubicon. What I'm talking about is today's podcast actually has a sponsor. Yes, someone actually wants to sponsor this content. Well, I travel a lot in my business, and I gotta tell you, I rely on the accuracy of information about a business that is contained on the internet. If I'm looking for a hotel, if I'm looking for a restaurant, I want to know hours of operation. I rely almost exclusively on the information on the internet. Well, as you can imagine, a lot of consumers, we lose trust and confidence in a local business when we find incorrect information about that business online. That's why Digital Directory Management is in business. They connect businesses with consumers at a national, local, and hyper-local levels by ensuring the accuracy and visibility of your business's location information on top search engines, directories, apps, and social networks. Hey, wherever people are looking to find your business. And so who is a good fit for Digital Directory Management? Well, do you have an online presence? You would be a good fit. Well, this solution is great for agencies, brands, and small to medium-sized businesses wanting to optimize and take control of their online presence. You know, consistent listing in various large directories create authority and tell the major search engines that your business is legitimate. Take control of your online presence today and to be seen by consumers who are searching for you. So, hey, if you want more information, you want to make sure your information is accurate for those who are looking for you, and if you want to receive a complimentary baseline report to see how your business is currently doing, well, then visit www.digitaldirectory.management. Again, that website is www.digitaldirectory.management. Hey, if you are driving and can't write that down, no worries. Just check out our show two notes, and you will find a link to that site. Now back to our regularly scheduled program. Well, it's great to be back with you on this podcast. We took a little bit of a break as I finished up my CLE travel season. So excited to get back doing these podcasts. And today my guest is Dan Williams. Dan, it's great to have you on our podcast again.
Thank you for having me.
Now, for those of you who do not know, Dan, you are a political commentator and a podcaster. You had a podcast, I believe, called The Common Sense Guy, and you are now taking that into a new direction. What are you doing with your podcast now?
Well, as I analyzed doing that Common Sense Guy, I realized that while that common sense is important.
Yeah, you realize you lacked common sense. I think that's, let's call it like we see it.
There is a possibility that some would say that's the actual issue here.
Because you're talking politics. I don't think anyone talking politics actually has common sense. Maybe that was just too much to chew. Maybe it's possible.
It is possible. I was actually trying to promote the idea that, you know, nobody's right about everything and nobody's wrong about everything, and there's probably a little bit of truth on both sides of most issues. But I found myself tilting just about every issue toward the left and ultimately basically talked myself into the idea that I needed to rebrand the concept.
All right. So which way are you going now with your podcasting future?
Well, right now the website name is theclassyliberal.com.
So you like oxymorons? I got that.
Twitter name is theclassylib because you can't have that many letters on a Twitter name.
All right.
But so I shorten that. The idea there is that I'm trending left on most political issues, but I want to maintain class. I don't want to be one of the far leftists that's yelling and calling names and not understanding that it is possible somebody on the right might have a good idea once in a while, too.
Well, then we should have some great conversations because I won't say I'm trending left. I like to think of myself right there in the center. So maybe I'm trending left from where I started, which is on the far right. But nonetheless, I probably still find myself pretty much on the right side of the issues, pun intended. But I do want to go back to our podcast a few months ago when you were on, because now you guys, listeners, you can go ahead and listen to it to verify what we are saying to be true. But that was before the Super Bowl.
Yes, it was.
And we pegged it. Did we not peg that Super Bowl?
I think we did quite well.
And you anticipate, what was your prediction of the final score?
I believe my prediction was 38-21.
And what was the final score?
31-20.
Not too bad, not too bad. Next time you make a prediction, I am going to then go to Las Vegas because I think I'll put my money where your mouth is. It worked out quite well.
I would have made a lot of money through the NFL playoffs this year if I had actually been betting.
Now, I actually did a thing in Las Vegas last year. And this was right when sports betting was becoming a thing nationally. You remember the Supreme Court rule that you got to allow, you can't prohibit sports gambling. And so my mind was on sports gambling, but I'm also married, and so I wasn't going to gamble any of our money. But I thought about it every week. And looking back, I would have made a mint, as I would have bet on the Chiefs every single week. And they, of course, won out and covered the spread with Mahomes. But what, any lasting impressions from the Super Bowl?
Lasting impressions from the Super Bowl? The Chiefs were a great team. San Francisco was also a great team. But there was one functional difference between the two.
And what's that?
The Chiefs have a Hall of Fame quarterback and the Niners do not.
That, you know what, that is the answer right there.
The rest of the teams, both teams have a lot of dynamic playmakers. Both teams have defensive playmakers. Coaching, I don't think, is a big issue. I think it comes down to the simple fact that Mahomes is a generational talent, and Garoppolo is probably just slightly above average.
And there's a reason why, more often than not, the stud quarterback wins out in the big games, and here's why. You have 2 weeks off, so assumably both sides have good coaches, right? You're there at the Super Bowl. You have good coaches to get to that point.
Right.
So you know the game plan going in is going to be strong for both sides. So you get to the fourth quarter. Game plans are kind of worn out. People are getting tired. Who's going to rise to the occasion? It's going to be the athletes on the field, and the Super Bowl caliber quarterback who can improvise in the moment is probably going to come out on top more times than not. I think that's what we saw happen in the Super Bowl.
That's very true. We go back even all the day to the days of Joe Montana, where there'd be a fourth quarter drive and a really difficult pass made right toward the end of the game to take the lead. And we saw that a lot of times throughout NFL history, where that great quarterback makes the difference at the end of the game. In this case, it didn't play out that way exactly, because the way the Chiefs ended up piling on the lead was actually the whole team.
Right.
There were some great defensive plays. There was running. You know, Damien Williams actually sealed the deal with a touchdown. But Mahomes certainly played a big part in getting them to the lead. And making that comeback final.
Now, Dan, I'm gonna challenge you right here, because I think I'm a bigger fan. And here's my point here: I have recorded the Super Bowl. Did you record it?
I did not.
Have you watched it since the Super Bowl?
I've watched a number of the packages, like the mic'd up packages and things that NFL films produce.
Right, right.
I have not gone back and watched the entire game.
See, I have. And it was even more beautiful the second time around. Even though you know the outcome, the movie, just as compelling. The plot line, probably even better to watch those San Francisco players celebrate when you know it's coming.
The question I have is, were the commercials better now that you know the outcome of the game?
I actually, that's the reason why I rewatched the Super Bowl. I didn't see the commercials the first time through, so I rewatched it just to see the commercials. So, yeah, you kind of caught me on that one. But nonetheless, let's move on here from the Super Bowl, or else we will be here all day. Let's go to our next topic here, which is the coronavirus. Dan, is the world coming to an end?
No.
Well, what's going on here with coronavirus? But, listeners, let me just kind of set the stage here for you. We actually recorded this 2 days ago. That would be Wednesday of the week, and I forgot to hit record, and so we are doing it again. And Dan and I were commenting on, wow, so much has changed over the last 2 days. 2 days ago, we were talking about who is going to win March Madness. Wow, times have changed.
They have. They have. It's been 48 hours, probably the most amazing 48 hours I've seen in, since 9/11.
Yeah.
As far as the impact on the world.
I'll tell you what, it has impacted us. I can't even sit down to use the restroom now without thinking, am I pulling too many squares out? Do I need to conserve and spare some squares for the future? Because it's a new world that we live in.
It's really hard to even comment on that concept. There's a difference between being prudent in how we go forward and canceling large events and then being, you know, moronic.
I don't know. Is it that we're all being prudent and wise as we just let this virus pass through us over the next couple of weeks? Or is this yellow journalism on steroids? This is being propped up by the media to instill panic so people... I tell you, yellow journalism is a time and honored tradition. Is tested. It's been found to be true for journalism. It increases the ratings the more you can create a sense of panic. So what is it?
At times, it's very concerning how much power the media actually does have as they get to control the narrative. They get to control which stories are being covered and how in-depth and what slant they want to put on them. Really, in many ways, that's too much power in the media. In this case, I think there were a lot of us that thought that it might be moving down the case of yellow journalism early. And then Italy happened.
But what happened in Italy?
And I think when we saw what was going on in Italy, a country that, for the most part, is you know, a Western nation with solid healthcare systems and in many ways a similar concept to what we have. I think at that point, we realized, hey, this is a big deal. And then we started seeing the pop-ups here in the U.S., particularly up in Seattle and with all the problems they had there and how fast this thing hit that nursing home community and just went right through it and just 30, I think it was 30 deaths.
Because as we are sitting here today, we don't really know when we're going to go back as a society.
No.
Schools are being closed right and left. I just saw last hour, the Masters is now being postponed. March Madness was for some reason canceled, which I got to admit, I don't understand why they canceled March Madness. Have they not heard of just postponing it? Why do you have to cancel?
They canceled everything. And I think that's something I didn't realize at first, is the NCAA canceled all spring sports. So they really think this is going to last well into May. And I believe they simply looked at the university calendar, doesn't allow, you know, kids graduate 1st of May. You just can't have collegiate events going beyond that. And if you did, you've got the College World Series that was supposed to take place at the end of May. But now that's not even happening. So they've really shut down. I mean, it's not just the basketball players. It's the swimmers. It's the track and field. It's baseball, softball. It's all these different things at the collegiate tennis, at the collegiate level that have been shut down for the rest of this year. It's amazing, really. Well,
now, obviously, we are not medical doctors. We are not experts when it comes to infectious diseases. We are trained in the law. And so let me just give you this thought. I am thinking that if coronavirus is being beaten back by lawyers, and this is what I mean now, it is possible some people are canceling these events because they're so concerned about the future of the human race. I'm just not buying that. I think they're afraid of lawsuits. You see it time and time again, companies doing the right thing, not because it's the right thing, they're afraid of being sued. And so what do you think? Do you think that, to a certain extent, lawyers are responsible for this safety measure, if you will, of people canceling these events? They don't want to be the ones that hold the event, and then it's determined that the coronavirus was spread through that event, and someone died, and so they are sued. And this is all a response to, we're afraid of lawyers.
Yes.
I like that.
Yes, I think that's very, very, very true. I think society runs in many ways with the threat of legal action overriding decision-making at times.
That's why you can't get hot coffee anymore at McDonald's. They're afraid of lawyers.
That's very true, too.
You can't go to Krispy Kreme and get your donut. No, you can still do that for now. But nonetheless, yeah, I do think in a lot of areas of society, people make decisions because they're afraid of the lawsuit. And I'm just wondering how much is that playing into this current craze.
Well, let's give an example here of the country still trying to figure this out on what the right stance is for all events. But yesterday there was supposed to be a Blake Shelton concert in Omaha.
Okay.
And Shelton announced mid-afternoon that he was canceling his tour.
All right.
And so they, you know, he's really sorry for the fans and all that, but he just doesn't want to put them in harm's way. At the same time, in Denver, Colorado, the Pepsi Center was announcing that the Post Malone concert for that night in Denver was going to continue.
All right.
And was going to go on. So in Omaha, you've got one setting where we're going to be cautious. We're not going to bring, you know, tens of thousands of people together in one arena. Whereas in Denver, they're like, well, yeah, we're not.
So
they're taking two different views. And to some extent, you could look at the legal background and say, maybe Shelton and his tour is a little more aware of what the potential pratfalls of the legalities are. And maybe in Denver, they're just not caring about that.
Well, let's unpack that lawsuit. So let's say we held March Madness. And so you hold an event here in Kansas City where you bring all these basketball teams into play. And somehow it's proven because you find out this person went to this event. Later was found out that person had coronavirus. Another person went to the event, sat right beside that person, did not have the coronavirus, and then caught it from being exposed to that person. Yeah, might there be a lawsuit against the organizers of that event for holding it when they had good reason to anticipate that being an outcome?
By yesterday afternoon, and we're talking on Friday, so that was Thursday. By Thursday afternoon, everybody in this country should have been aware of what was going on. So anybody that's continuing activities beyond that point is doing so with full awareness that the medical advice, the concepts, the governmental concepts are to shut down all large events. And so it seems like that's setting up a standard for what would a reasonable person do in the courtroom, what was reasonable in that setting.
Let's unpack that just a bit.
And that gets interesting.
Let's assume nothing happens. All right. Well, then there's no lawsuits.
Right.
We understand. All right. The person was wrong for being fearful. This is yellow journalism. This is all panicking. Yeah, grow up, right? There's that thought if nothing happens. But if there is a pandemic and people, the spreads like people are anticipating it might, in retrospect, they will say, well, you should have known all the other major sporting events in the United States, if not the world, were canceling. What information did you have to counteract the prevailing wisdom? And so it's the fact that everyone is canceling is causing everyone else to be subject to liability if they do not cancel as well, and then the worst ends up happening.
That is very possible. Once you set that, as any attorney who's been in court knows in litigation, once you set that reasonableness standard, it becomes problematic.
Yeah, and it would be hard to say that you didn't think about it.
Yeah, that you weren't aware of the issue. That's almost impossible for anybody who runs a big event like that.
All right, well, there you go. There is a coronavirus story being beaten back by the lawyers. Hey, I got to give a shout out to my profession. Now let's bring to our listeners some of these wacky case updates, because I'm telling you, the last couple of weeks have been a bonanza of interesting, fun cases. Too many probably to cover today. We might have to carry this through next week. Dan, here's the first case I want to bring to your attention and to our listeners. This is a case where this guy was driving through Florida and he was speeding. Now, right there, I got to tell you, I identify with this person. I have a lead foot. I get way too many speeding tickets. But nonetheless, I'm a lawyer, so I know how to handle that. But nonetheless, this guy was speeding. He was stopped. Now, while stopped, the police are allowed to look in your car. Did you know that?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, what is in plain view? And now the cops can't just open up your trunk and start searching through your trunk. They can't be picking things up and looking underneath hoods and things like that. But if it's in plain view, then the cops can look. And so because of that, you don't want to have contraband in plain view. Now, Dan, I assume you don't carry too much contraband in your car. Is that right?
Not usually, no.
All right. But let's just say you did. Hypothetically, you had some contraband. Let's say you just came through Colorado. You picked up some, I don't want to go there. But nonetheless, let's just say you picked up some...
Just for a point here, if I were to come back with my back seat loaded with Whataburger bags, would that be considered contraband?
Are you in a carb-friendly state? I do believe in some states where they are outlawing Coke over 12 ounces, the Whataburgers might be contraband.
This could be a problem.
It could be a problem.
It may be. Someday I may do that.
All right. Well, nonetheless, this person was stopped for speeding, and in his car, in plain view, he had a bag, and this bag was labeled bag full of drugs. Now, Dan, what are your first thoughts? You have a law degree, right? You've been trained in the law. You have a bag in the car that says bag full of drugs. Is this guy an idiot? Or do you think this is irony?
Well, boy, there's a lot of lawyer jokes that could be inserted here, but we'll avoid those. I'm not going to call him an idiot, but he certainly doesn't seem to be super bright.
Now, you know, you don't know what's in the bag yet.
No.
Right? You're just saying you have a bag in your car. It's labeled bag full of drugs. Is this guy an idiot for driving around with a bag in his car that says, hey, the dead body is located in the trunk. Look here.
My take to that would always be, you can have the thing in the car that says the dead body's in the trunk if there's not a dead body in the trunk.
Right.
If there is, then that probably is not a good idea.
If you just came from some mafia hit, let's just say, and you are transporting a dead body in the car, in the trunk, you're saying it would not be the best legal advice to advise your client to have a sign informing a cop of such.
It seems that that's not wise.
All right. Well, now let's move on with the story. And so the cop sees this bag full of bags and thinks, you know what? There's drugs in this car. So the cops then search this bag in this car. Now, right here, do you think the cop is acting, you don't know what's in the bag yet. Has the cop violated this person's Fourth Amendment rights? Now, for our listeners, the Fourth Amendment is this law that prohibits government, cops in particular, from searching through your private matters and affairs without probable cause.
It certainly would be questionable enough that I could see plenty of reason to think that they could have probable cause.
Okay, because you have a sign that says, hey, cops, I got a bag full of drugs in here. So that might be probable cause. Again, you don't know yet what's in the bag.
You add that to the fact that the person's been pulled over for speeding, so the person's already doing something illegal to get to the point of them seeing the car. It does give them even more reason to think, okay, this person's on the way somewhere with a delivery or something like that.
All right, so now the cops then search this bag, and guess what they find?
Hopefully not a dead body.
And not laundry. And not Whataburgers. They found a bag full of drugs. Yes, that's exactly what was in that bag. So this guy's got to go up in the Hall of Fame of the 10 most stupidest, dumbest criminals in history. You have a bag in your car labeled bag full of drugs. And what are you going to put in that bag? A bag full of drugs.
I wouldn't do that, but, to each their own.
I am thinking if I had come from Walmart, I might have did a bag shift. I might have put the chicken wings in the bag full of drugs and put the drugs in the Walmart bags. That might have been a little bit better idea than keeping. But you know what? Labeling is important. I know my wife would be a big supporter. Let's label things accurately. If you're going to contain, crack cocaine, put your crack cocaine in the bag labeled bag full of drugs.
It would seem to me that if you're ordering a bag full of drugs bag from, say, Amazon or wherever, the whole point would be the joke element, and you put something else in it and then put it in your back dash or window or something, then basically just as a joke concept. Order one and carry real illegal drugs in it, somebody missed the whole point, I think.
So I am thinking if he did not have a bag full of drugs, he probably could have sued the cops under this theory that the cops did not have probable cause to search for the reasons you just gave, right? Most likely, there's not going to be drugs in this bag, right? Most likely, you're not going to buy a bag full of drugs, then actually put drugs in that bag. So if it contained, let's just say, Snickers bars, they probably could have sued the cops saying, you violated my Fourth Amendment rights. But listeners, just trust me on this one. I am a lawyer. I am a practicing lawyer, all right? if you actually have crack cocaine in that bag full of drugs, that argument is not going to fly. It's just not going to work. The judge is going to like roll his eyes, laugh under his breath. Heck, it might not even be under his breath. It might be laughing out loud at your stupidity, and they're going to allow that evidence in. That's my take on it. Do you have another take?
I think that's probably right.
All right. Now, moving on here now to our next interesting story. I am going to suggest that Lady Justice should sue Congress for defamation under the theory that the impeachment was actually a trial. The impeachment does not resemble a trial in the least bit. Now, Dan, what is your thoughts there? Here's where I'm going with this. The impeachment, if you go to look at the Constitution gives the House of Representatives the right to bring charges of impeachment. And then it's going to be tried by the Senate, and then the Chief Justice is going to preside over it. That sounds like a trial.
It is a trial, but it's not the same thing we see in a courtroom.
Now, what do you mean by that? Because I got to agree that what we saw there at the Senate with the impeachment trial would never pass muster in any courtroom across this country. But why do you say that?
Well, two things. One, there's no law guiding the decisions. You see in courtrooms, judges have to follow the law, or at least that's the idea. And so attorneys can appeal, they can make arguments. That's an invalid direction or whatever you want to say. In an impeachment trial, the political arm can do whatever they want. There's no law that's guiding them once it's open. The only thing that the law is guiding is how impeachment works.
Yeah, and it says that a president or any other official can be impeached for a high crime or misdemeanor or bribery or treason. And then if those charges are brought, then you're going to have a trial. But under normal trials, you would never allow the decision maker to come to that trial or participate if they have overt bias, a prejudicial bias, if they have made out-of-court statements that really demonstrate that they're kind of predisposed one way or the other, you're never going to allow that person to sit on the jury. You're never going to let that person, be a judge in that case. And here, do you not have a situation where bias ran rampant throughout the senators and...
Politicians inherently are biased. It's the exact opposite of what the legal system is supposed to be. The legal system works in part because of the idea that we remove the bias. Now, those of us who've worked in it probably understand that at a basic level, that's impossible, that we all as humans have bias. But politically, it's outward bias. It's something that is expected to be there. And political bias, you do not get rid of in an impeachment trial. It's there for the whole time.
In fact, one could say that their vote in that impeachment trial will impact their chances of being reelected. So they all have an inherent economic incentive, definitely a political incentive because they want to win reelection. That is going to guide their vote, which maybe as a democratic society we like, but I'm telling you, as far as a trial is concerned, you would never allow that kind of bias to enter into any kind of case.
It's one thing we deal with courts in the federal system. Now, state can be different in how they get their judges, and some states elect and others appoint. But in the federal system, you're appointed for life. So they should never have to worry that their ruling in a decision will directly impact their job.
Right.
Whereas you get into politics, and every decision that a politician makes could very well be the defining event that causes them to lose their next election. And that is always front and center with politicians.
You would never allow that bias. If you had anything remotely approaching that level of bias in an actual trial, you would get that judge recused, you would get that juror thrown off the jury, and it wouldn't even be a close call. But again, with our impeachment trial, that was standard operating procedure. All right, another reason why I think the impeachment trial resembled nothing of a trial is the fact that there were no set laws that were being used that were subject to the case. In other words, if you ever go a standard in our criminal justice system is the laws have to be specific. In other words, you as a person under the law has to have some kind of reliance on that law that, yeah, based upon how that law is written, I know that my conduct is either proscribed or prescribed by that law. If I act this way, I'm going to be in violation of that law. If I don't act that way, I might be okay. I mean, you have to have that kind of certainty. But here with the impeachment trial, there is no real law that's set.
The charges, the two counts that were brought against President Trump were abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The obstruction of Congress charge is particularly unique because that's something that could be brought against any president, because presidents and Congress are always fighting over very, you know, what has to be turned over to a congressional committee and what doesn't, and quite often go to the courts. In this case, the House did not let it get through the court system, so they simply charged the president with that. I personally don't think that was a valid charge. The abuse of power also is
not specific.
What is
abuse of power?
It's vague. And so one person could think abuse of power is one thing and another person could think it's another. The truth is, abuse of power in a political sense is probably that the person did something you didn't agree with politically.
That could be considered abuse of power. When President Obama said, under his breath to, I believe it was Putin, that, after I get elected, we'll have some more flexibility on how we handle this. How is that not an abuse of power? But nonetheless, he wasn't impeached. And so because that is a very vague standard, that would never pass in a court of law. But in the impeachment trial, hey, you know what? It's going to work. Because it is a political proceeding. And so if the constituents approve of what their senators are doing, they will respond by voting them back into office. If they don't disapprove, then they might vote them out of office. And I guess that's positive, because at the end of the day, the American people have the last word.
That seems to be true. Although one of the things to consider here when you're talking about the U.S. Senate serving as a jury is you need 2/3. So you need 67 senators, and neither party's had that kind of majority. So what you're looking at is you have to have senators of the president's own party vote again to remove the president from office. And then it becomes simple math. And Andrew Yang loves to talk about it's math. This is math. Even if the senator from the president's own party wants to remove the president, doesn't like the president, would much rather see somebody else in office, all of that. And I'm sure there's been some of that now. Even if that happens, that person facing re-election is likely to find a very angry primary electorate in their state that still likes the president. And all you have to have is, you don't have to have a presidential approval rating of 50% nationwide. All you have to have in that state is a presidential approval rating of 51% of primary election voters that are committed to the president. And if you have that, then if that senator votes to remove the president, now that senator is very likely to face a presidential, a Trump-supported, in this case, primary challenge in their next election and may well lose.
All right, there you go. So there is definitely an inherent bias. There are no concrete standards. Nothing resembling a trial, but yet we went through it as a society and probably will again. Now, moving on here now to our next interesting story from last week. Here I found this story where this lawyer was, he was a defense lawyer, and his defense attorney, Anthony Baker, and he was in court defending this guy who was charged with beating his spouse, hitting his spouse. And so the defense that he wanted to make in this case was self-defense, that the other person attacked him first and he was just responding, so this was self-defense. And he asked the judge to give an instruction to the jury of self-defense. The judge would not give that instruction. Now, Dan, have you ever been in court and the judge has ruled against you? As a lawyer, not I'm not talking about your criminal defendant ways. We're going to leave that for a future podcast. But as a lawyer, has a judge ever ruled against you?
It's hard to remember specifics, but I suspect it probably did happen a time or two.
All right. And I'm just curious. How did you respond? Did you throw it? Did you go on the floor, thrust your hands out, screaming like a toddler giving a tantrum?
For the most part, I accepted it and started to advise my client accordingly.
Yeah, you just moved on.
Yeah, that's what you have to do.
Yeah, that's not what this guy did. This guy then decided to do a demonstration, and he got up from his seat, left his client there, walked over to the holding cell where they apparently held criminals awaiting trial, and then basically just said, I'm not going to play along anymore. I'm going to sit down right here and throw a little tantrum. Now, I assume you've never done that in court.
No, I have not.
Yeah, I went to KU Law. They did not teach us to do the tantrum. So the judge here, this is where I'm getting, this is where I find this case hilarious. The judge was not amused, and so the judge went all grade school on this lawyer, and he actually ordered this lawyer to write sentences as punishment for what he did. Now, I assume that when you were in grade school, you might have had to write sentences on the chalkboard. That's exactly what happened here. The judge made this lawyer get out pen and paper and write down 25 times this sentence. I will not engage in conduct that's prejudicial to the administration of justice or in any other conduct that adversely reflects on my fitness to practice law. So that is what this judge ordered this lawyer to do. Have you ever in your entire practice career ever witnessed something as crazy as this kind of order from the judge?
That is unique. I hope it had to be like we all had when we were in school, and I hope it was in cursive. And it had to be grammatically correct. So,
you know what? Or write it again. Hey, if I can't read it, do it
exactly.
Again.
Exactly.
Yeah, so listeners, if you actually want to see this, go to our show notes here on this podcast, and we'll have a copy there of those 25 sentences that this lawyer had to write. But Dan, it brings up this interesting question. I think this judge is onto something. Maybe we should be doing more with creative sentencing. Have you ever done creative sentencing with, let's say, your kids?
Absolutely.
I definitely wanted to do that when one of my children, I won't say which one, would hit the other. Yeah, the thought comes in your mind that, you know what, maybe if he can get a dose of his own medicine, that wouldn't be the worst thing.
That's exactly. Any parent of multiple children has dealt with that concept. And we have to be creative.
Yeah.
Or it won't work.
Right. You know what?
It's always a good idea to get to, there's a retribution concept that is very appealing both to you as the parent to teach the child that's misbehaving, and that certainly is pleasant for the victim to see the perpetrator getting the retribution.
You know what? If it works in parenting, maybe it will work in court. And I found another Ohio judge, which just dawned on me. Both of these judges are from Ohio. There's got to be a story there somewhere. But this is another judge. He's a municipal court judge in Lake County, Ohio. Michael Cicinetti. Michael Cicinetti was a municipal court judge in Lake County, Ohio, and he was famous for his creative sentencing. For example, a woman once was charged with or found guilty of abandoning 35 kittens in a forest. And he ordered this lady to spend a night in the woods, just like those poor 35 kittens. Dan, what do you think of that sentence?
Well, it makes me wonder if 35 kittens make a noise in the forest. Never mind. Okay, so
First of all,
how do you get 35 kittens? This is the first thing that comes to mind on this.
That is a really good question.
I mean, what? That's got to be a kitten mill, right?
Where do you get 35 kittens? Do you have like a black lab and just trying to grow her own dog food? Where do you get 35 kittens?
I mean, it's my understanding that a normal litter is anywhere from 3 to 10 kittens, but you're talking, you could be as many as 10 litters there. What's going on at your house or whatever that you end up with 35 kittens?
That's crazy.
Kittens are incredibly cute. Let's be honest. It's horrible that they'd be put in the forest.
But 35?
They won't survive.
Right.
But how you get 35 of them, that alone sounds something more nefarious there is going on than just the forest, although that's bad enough.
All right, how about this next one? Two teenagers who scrawled 666 on a nativity figure of Jesus had to lead a donkey through the streets with a sign saying, Sorry for the jackass offense, but he is so cute. With four different O's or after that on that. So, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's an animal cruelty element that sounds like it could be here. I don't know what the donkey did to be part of this, but...
That's right.
But the truth is, it's creative. A little bit of play there.
Yeah.
Maybe we could have had the kids write 25 times Matthew 28 or something, and maybe that would have been better. But the point is, well taken.
All right. How about this next one? Teenagers who flattened tires on a school bus were ordered to throw a picnic for the primary school children whose outing was canceled due to the prank. That's pretty creative there. That is directly tying the offense to the ramification of those teenagers' conduct. What do you think about this sentence?
I like that one. I think that one is excellent because so often, particularly with teenagers and or very young perpetrators, they don't have a full understanding of the impact of their behavior. That whatever, they go do this and, oh, ha ha, that's fun. And it's not that big a deal. And they don't see what has to go on after the fact and what somebody has to do to clean it up.
Yeah,
or
great.
Who isn't able to do what they were planning to do because of it. And I like the idea of finding a way to show them the exact impact.
And then make them somehow fix it.
Exactly.
I do like that one. All right, how about this next one? A man who committed a traffic violation while shouting pigs at police. Now, right there, I got to stop. You can't do that. Now, I have been stopped for my fair share of speeding tickets. Apparently, I have a lead foot, but hey, I'm a lawyer. I know how to get around those things. But nonetheless, if you're stopped by a cop, don't call him a pig. That's just not a wise idea.
It's not good.
This guy controls your future freedom to a certain extent, or else can really make your life unpleasant. He's just doing his job. Don't call him a pig. All right, well, that's what this man did. And so as a punishment, he was made to stand on a street corner with a 350-pound pig and a sign that said, "This is not a police officer."
I blame Die Hard.
Why is that?
The scene in Die Hard where the cop backs his car backwards and gets out of the car and he's covered with donuts and Twinkies or whatever it is.
That's right. All right.
I think for a generation of us here in America, that forever more emblazoned in our head the image of a cop. So the pig thing just seems to be a play on that. But back to the issue with the donkey. Again, we've got an animal here that's being forced to participate in something that they didn't do anything to deserve. So
exactly. Instead, they should have a sign that says 350-pound pig and a sign that said, "This is not a police officer. This is tomorrow's dinner. Fire up the smoker. We are going to have a barbecue." But hey, I agree. At least it's not a police officer.
Well, actually, you could have solved the first grade class party along with this one at the same time.
Oh, this judge has been thinking along those lines.
We could have combined sentences there.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I love it. All right, how about this one? This one has got this is fascinating. This one. A woman who pled guilty to assault for using pepper spray on a man was given the choice to serve 30 days in jail or serve 3 days of community service and be shot herself with pepper spray. Now, then let me stop right there. Have you ever been shot in the face with pepper spray?
No.
All right. So you have no idea how it would feel.
I've heard explanations of it.
Oh, what did you hear?
I know when, I believe, I don't know if it's all members of the military, but I know certain members of the military, maybe SEALs and all, as through training, go in and have to experience things like that.
Fascinating.
For periods of time so that their bodies can somewhat get used to it. You hear the stories about what that's like to actually go in and do that, and it doesn't sound pleasant.
So would you take this deal? Which one would you take? 30 days in jail or serve 3 days of community service plus get sprayed in the face with pepper spray?
So freedom or pain?
Yeah, which one would you take?
I'll take pain.
All right, that is what she took. She said, "I'll take the 3 days of community service and I'll be shot in the face with pepper spray." And so the judge said, "All right," took this can out, sprayed her right in the face, but it was just water. Apparently they did not have the guts to actually use pepper spray. I got it. As I was reading the story, I thought, there is no way they're going to shoot someone in the face with pepper spray. That had to have been Eighth Amendment violation, cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, yes, that would be an issue. However, I have a feeling the judge figures that the simple apprehension of the woman for however long it led up to that spray was enough of a punishment.
You're probably right. She definitely probably
she
in
got
her mind,
the point.
She probably thought through how bad this is going to be.
Yeah.
No, I got that. That makes sense. And so that maybe proved his point, and she did not do this again. And by the way, I have researched this judge who has these creative sentencing. Apparently, he has a really low recidivism rate. Apparently, it does work in his court. Maybe we should go somewhere with this. I don't know. Hey, listeners, if you have any ideas of creative punishments, I do want to hear from you. Go to our Facebook page or just email me. I'd like to hear your ideas on creative punishments, both when it comes to teenagers and also in the court of law. All right, finally, Dan, I want to cover this last crazy story that I came across recently. In this case, it speaks to me because it deals with airline etiquette. Now, Dan, I fly a lot. I assume you fly in your work?
I don't more than I have to, but I do sometimes.
All right, and you're a big guy like me, and so there's some etiquette that goes in when you fly. I want to just cover some of these airline etiquettes with you, see what you think. First of all, you sit down in a plane, and you sit down next to a person, all right? You get what I'm saying here? Do you engage in conversation with that person, or do you let them be?
I let them be, but I will talk to them if they want to talk.
All right, so if you ask them a question and they then put an ear phone back in their ear, you are going to let them just be. You're not going to take that as an opportunity to engage in further dialogue. All right, how about this one? How many times do you use the restroom when you are in the inside seat?
Zero.
You won't use the restroom at all?
Oh, I hate using plane restrooms.
All right. Have you ever sat in the inside seat?
The most recent flights I've been on were actually to Alaska. So you're looking at almost 4 hours on the plane to Seattle and then 4 hours from there. And it's a long haul. So I just don't drink anything on those days until I get to my final destination because right. I don't want to use the bathroom on a plane.
Then how about this one? We're talking about airline etiquette. Clipping your toenails, is that allowed or is that somehow taboo in the airline industry?
Well, taboo, allowed, and totally gross, right. Probably three different standards.
I'm thinking you probably can get reset if the person next to you decides to clip their toenails, but that actually is obviously a fake one. This is a real situation. We're talking about reclining your seat. What do you think about that? Are you a recliner?
No.
You don't?
No.
So has there ever been a situation where someone has reclined into your seat?
Yes. Yeah, I've seen that.
What did you do?
Just didn't do anything.
You just let it be.
The only time it would be an issue, really, is if I've got food or something right there, and they usually go around and have everybody put their seats up when they're serving food.
Right. Well, this woman was flying on this airline, American Airlines, I believe, and Wendy Williams was her name, and she reclined her seat, and the guy behind her was not happy. And he decided to punch this passenger's seat. Now, Dan, I have felt like doing that before, but no, I never lived out that thought. I'm just realizing, you know what, this might be unpleasant, but it does not call for actually punching the person's seat in front of me.
We all have frustrations from time to time. We all think of things, undoubtedly, that we could do that might show our frustration. But we don't do them. This guy needs to learn that lesson.
Yes.
One thing to be frustrated with her for reclining. It's another thing to maybe even mention it to her or a steward or stewardess. But it's not cool to start punching the seat.
So apparently she then started to videotape him punching her seat. And so a flight attendant was called. And the flight attendant came to her and asked her to delete that video. Now, Dan, I have no idea where this is going. So the flight attendant apparently took the side of the guy behind who was being reclined into.
Something tells me there's a lot more to that story.
Yeah, there has to be, because that is odd.
Let's be fair. At the very least, on the flight attendant's part, we have an issue of somebody that is thinking of what the legal ramification might be and probably has a warped understanding of how that works.
I guess. Hey, you know, we don't want to be a subject of any kind of YouTube viral video. Please delete the video. This person did not. But this passenger then threatened a lawsuit. Now, Dan, just pause right here. Who do you think she threatened to sue? We're talking about the person who reclined her seat. She's threatening a lawsuit. Who is she suing?
Well, I'm sure she could claim some physical. I think she had a neck issue, so I'm sure she could try to claim some physical against the guy himself.
That's what you'd be thinking, right?
I definitely would think that she would, in this case, go after the airline because, one, the deep pockets concept, and, two, they're the ones in control of the situation, ultimately.
All right. I guess I was thinking like a lawyer. My thought would be she would sue the person behind who's actually hitting her. But no, she, as you pointed out, you always are thinking like a lawyer who has the deep pockets. It would be American Airlines, and let's sue them. And so she sued them for defamation. Because in their relaying of the story, it sure made her look out to be the bad person. She did not like that. And so she threatened a lawsuit. Last I checked, she has not followed through with that threat. And I do not believe a lawsuit has been filed yet. But nonetheless, one has been, at least that is what is being threatened, that maybe American Airlines will face a lawsuit. I love what her response was here when she was asked about this threat of lawsuit. She said, "They have pushed me way too far."
Well, that seems appropriate.
Yeah, there's nothing more you can say. Drop the mic, exit stage left. So there you go, Dan. That's our WIKA case review from this last week. Thank you so much for joining us, and hope we can have you on again in the future.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the crazier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom, well, let's just face it, this entire operation would be a complete and utter mess. Yeah, just like my garage. Our marketing team, Redbird Solutions, and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us, and Sean Nguyen and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And finally, Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.